Good morning. This is the Book Club at 91.7 on WVXU and WMUB. I'm Mark Purcell. On the phone with me is New York Times bestselling author and the co-creator of the HBO series Vinyl, Rich Cohen. He's also the author of many great books like Tough Jews, The Avengers, and Monsters, and his new book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Rich Cohen, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks for having me.
I noticed in the back of the book you talk about this is a book you've been working on pretty much for a lifetime, but you only started in earnest a few years ago. What caused you to come to write The Sun, the Moon, and the Rolling Stones?
Well, like you said, you know, I've been a Rolling Stones fan since I was a little kid, and then early on in my life as a writer, I had this opportunity to travel with the band for Rolling Stone magazine, write some stories, and then work on this Mick Jagger that became Vinyl. And it never really occurred to me to write a book about it, but what happened is I was driving around with my son, who's 12, and I was listening to his music, and it suddenly just flashed through my head, you know, this music sucked. And then I sort of thought, well, maybe it's just because I'm now the old guy, you know, what my dad was the old guy, and now I'm the old guy, and he never liked what I liked, so maybe I should do some research, because I'm a reporter, and I can figure out what's really going on. And I did some research, and I realized that this music does suck. And that's how I felt about it, and I felt that rock and roll was so important when I was growing up. I was born in 1968, and we sort of look forward to the next record like it could sort of change your life, and it could give direction to your summer, and we waited for the new record the way you'd wait for, you know, the new iPhone or whatever people are waiting for now, and that sort of died. That sense of rock and roll as a movement heading somewhere died. I feel like it died when Kurt Cobain died. I was working at Rolling Stone then, and just kind of went away, you know, and I sort of thought, you know what, nobody's stepped back and told the whole big story of rock and roll. There's been a lot of books about different bands and a lot of books about the Rolling Stones, but I was born later, I'm younger, and I felt like I was in a position to write this story. It's sort of like you have to know the end to understand the beginning, and that is really what gave me this idea to write this book about rock and roll, and I thought the best way to do it is to write about the Rolling Stones, because they're the greatest rock and roll band. They're the only one from the beginning that's still going. And they're a band that I had a personal relationship with and knew something about. And that's how I got to doing it.
Well, the Rolling Stones started out, what I love about the book, you talk about this being a history of rock and roll, and it really is, because this isn't specifically about the Rolling Stones, because there are so many other musicians involved in the book and your storytelling. I mean, your list of interviewees in the back of the book is a page and a half long. And while it's not all people you interviewed for the book, it's people that you've crossed paths with as a journalist and as a writer that you say are all part of the culmination of this book.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the Rolling Stones, the thing that really defines the Rolling Stones more than anything else is taste. They have great taste. When they were young, they liked the best music, and they later learned from and ripped off the best music. They have the best taste sort of in musicians, clothes, cities they lived in, and they had the best taste in people. You know, they had this incredible ability, I think, really driven by Mick Jagger, to find out who was around on the scene doing interesting things and get near that person and work with that person. And so I felt like their path crossed with so many other interesting people that if you told their story and sort of were free in it and let yourself follow the other people they met, you tell the entire story of that baby boomer generation. I'm like Generation X, I guess. So I sort of thought it as, you know, the sort of story of the baby boomers told by Generation X, which are like my older siblings. And I'm talking about, you know, from the beginning, working with people like, I don't know, you'd have to think about it, but Chuck Berry and the guys at Chess Records and Marshall Chess and the blues guys in Chicago, and later on intersecting with all the bands like the Beatles in some way, Lennon and McCartney were really important to the Rolling Stones. They kind of wrote for the Rolling Stones, the first Rolling Stones song, all the way up to Sonny Barger, who's one of the guys who started the Hells Angels and was at Altamont, and, you know, Andy Warhol, and that their story to me was sort of the story of the time.
I'm speaking with Rich Cohen about his book, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, available where books are sold and at libraries. You can learn more about it at our website, wvxu.org. Well, the Stones were always set up to be the anti-Beatles, or, you know, and to be competitors for the Beatles, be the grungier Beatles, if you may. But it was Lennon and McCartney who really helped the Stones put together their first big hit. I found that fascinating in the book.
Yeah, I mean, when you step back, you can see what happened, which is, the Rolling Stones were, you know, in their basement working on their music, and suddenly the Beatles broke. And at that moment, there was a race, because suddenly there was proven to be a market for this music, which no one knew existed. There was money to be made. And there was a race from all these different kind of hustlers and record men and record executives to find the next Beatles. And that's the British invasion. That's the explosion of bands. And they were all sold as the next Beatles, the Rolling Stones included. And what happened is that the Rolling Stones manager and the Rolling Stones themselves realized, first of all, they were not constitutionally suited to be the next Beatles. They were kind of messy and kind of ugly and sloppy, and people thought they were kind of dirty. And they suddenly had this realization, which is, the Beatles actually have created a niche, which is, you don't need another Beatles, you need the anti-Beatles. So that's how they were sold. They were in a niche created by the Beatles. So the Beatles would be love and the Stones would be sex. Now, the Beatles themselves realized this before the Rolling Stones did. So when they started looking for songs to sing, the Stones had trouble finding them and writing them at the beginning. And Andrew Lou Goldham was the Stones' manager, who was sort of in charge of all this branding. And he'd worked with the Beatles, and he ran into John Lennon and Paul McCartney on the street in London, brought them into the pub where the Stones were rehearsing, and they talked to them, and they sat down, and they wrote the Rolling Stones' second single, their first single that wasn't a blues cover, and that was I Want to Be Your Man. And they had sort of realized that this would be the Rolling Stones' template, which is, it would be these kind of pop blues songs that were kind of dirty and about comeuppance. And so, to me, that's fascinating, because you always think of them as competitors, but they really weren't. They kind of worked both sides of the same story. And, you know, for many years, the Rolling Stones and the Beatles were careful not to release songs or records within 6 months of each other. And they worked together, but it really took the Beatles to write the first Rolling Stones song.
You went on tour, followed the Rolling Stones on tour in, 1994, I believe. And this was after you went to see them play in 1989 on the Steel Wheels tour down in New Orleans. And you said you were reluctant to go see them then, but it seems your attitude changed when you got to meet the boys up close.
Well, I was, you know, Rolling Stones fanatic as a kid. And the first actual Stones concert I saw was in Chicago, where I grew up, at the Rosemont Horizon, and that was for Tattoo U, which was actually a great record, and kind of the last really good Stones record, in my opinion. So, and then, you know, I got older, and I went down to school in New Orleans, and suddenly I was seeing bands in bars. And I was like, oh, my God, so this is really where you should see a rock band. A rock band belongs in a bar. And the experience is much about the crowd and being in the crowd as about the band on the stage. And it was sort of the era of the mosh pit and everybody slamming into each other. And the Stones came, and it was sort of like, you know, your first love coming to town. And somebody gave me tickets, and they played at the Superdome. And it was sort of, you know, I sat at the very top of the Superdome, and it was like the Rolling Stones were just something happening in the distance. It was very hard to get into it. And it's sort of like arena rock, which is a whole thing I grew up with, a sort of an abomination. It perverted all the original principles of rock and roll, which is about spontaneity, craziness, being in the crowd, being drunk, being insane. And I sort of thought, you know, that for me had died. And then a couple years later, really just a couple years later, I was working at Rolling Stone magazine, and I got this crazy offer to go and watch the Rolling Stones rehearse for their next tour. This was the next tour after the one I'd seen in New Orleans. I was like 24 years old or something. Of course, I jumped at that as a writer and as a music person, but just the idea to have this great subject to write about. And what's amazing is, just before they went on tour, I got invited to this little pop-up gig they played at a bar in Toronto, just to get before an audience before they went into the big arenas. And now I was seeing the Rolling Stones in a little bar. And what you realize is, okay, so this is what the Rolling Stones really are. They're the greatest bar band in history. And that really is their natural habitat. And when people say to me, well, I saw the Rolling Stones and they were just all right, I saw them at the Meadowlands, I'm always like, well, you didn't really see the Rolling Stones. I mean, the Rolling Stones exist only in a bar, like at 1 in the morning when the crowd's completely crazy, everybody's drunk, Keith Richards has found the groove, and Mick Jagger has remembered who he really is. You know, which is not the guy dancing all around on a cherry picker 300 feet in the air, but the guy with the tight little rock and roll band right behind him singing blues songs.
Rich Cohen, his book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Learn more about it at our website, WVXU.org. And, of course, when it comes to the history of the Rolling Stones, the incident at Altamont Speedway in California and the deaths around that happened at that concert were kind of the low point for the Stones. And you save that for the latter part of the book. And I'm just curious, the book isn't necessarily set up along a timeline. It jumps back and forth in time. But I'm curious why you saved Altamont towards the end.
Well, to me, Altamont, like when I write a book, one of the things that's really important is the structure. And the order of things tells the story as much as the words or anything else. And I try to identify what the structure is in a story. And, you know, I went in writing this with the idea I was with them in the 90s. I was going to tell that whole story. And when I started really stepping back and thinking about it, I realized the Rolling Stones, as they were created as the anti-Beatles by Andrew Lou Goldham, their manager, that project ended at Altamont. Because the Beatles were good, the Stones were going to be bad or evil. And that became their subject matter. And you see that in songs like Paint It Black, Sympathy for the Devil, Play with Fire. It was always this idea that Mick Jagger is Lucifer. And it was, you know, an act. It wasn't real. But people believed it was real. And in the 60s, people believed this music was heading somewhere. And what happened at Altamont, to me, is that the Rolling Stones had, through the 60s, been throwing a big party every night, and Mick Jagger went to that party dressed as the devil. And what happened at Altamont is the real devil showed up. And suddenly the mask was pulled off of Mick Jagger. He had to step out of character. And this idea that they were this deeper, almost satanic force was revealed as kind of absurd. And after that, it's sort of like the hangover of that moment, and you have a different kind of band. And that's the band I grew up with. They still made many great records, and maybe their greatest record, Exile on Main Street, but it's really the hangover from that moment. So to me, structuring it, Altamont becomes hugely important because Altamont is the end of the first iteration of the Rolling Stones, and Exile on Main Street and the 70s is the hangover. And that's when the drug switch from LSD, which is all about aspiration, to heroin, which is all about numbing every sensation. So, and that's when I grew up. So I feel like it's the party, really, and I grew up in the time of the hangover. And that became really the mood of the music, and that's why Altamont's so important in the story of the Rolling Stones.
I found it interesting in the book where you said you thought Some Girls was the last good album by the Rolling Stones, and I have to say I concur with that. But I also was surprised, most of the way through the book, to read that you've talked to all the living members of the Rolling Stones except Bill Wyman.
The reason I didn't talk to Bill Wyman is, and I had some exchanges with him and stuff, but I never sat down and interviewed him, is because by the time I showed up to interview them and hang out with them, Bill Wyman was out of the band. He left the band after Steel Wheels. He had this big scandal with his dating this very young girl, and he'd been replaced by Daryl Jones, who was a bass player still with the band, who's from Chicago. So he was just out of the Rolling Stones, and it's interesting because that band, you know, there was a line, and when I interviewed them originally, is Keith Richards said, you know, I look around and I see, before we go on stage, it's just me, Mick, Ronnie, and Charlie, and that's all it's ever been, and that we know each other since before rock and roll. But really, the heart of it was Mick and Keith, and really Brian Jones, who died in 1969. So basically, if you're born late, you come late, there's some sacrifices you make, and one is you don't get to meet everybody you want, either because they left the band or because they're dead or because everybody's just old. And in return for that, what you get is perspective.
Well, Rich, thank you very much for giving me new perspective on the Rolling Stones, because I think even for people who think they know a lot about the Rolling Stones, I'll learn a lot from reading your book. Thanks for being on the book club at 91.7.
Thanks so much. Really fun to talk.
Rich Cohen. The book is The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones. Learn more at our website, wvxu.org. This is The Book Club at 91.7.